Hello, and welcome to our program, Reader's Digest, brought to you by OWL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio. I'm John Fisher, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from Reader's Digest here on OWL Radio. First, a life well lived. Their dad died of COVID-19. Now, they're trying to get the clever word he made up into the dictionary. From the Washington Post, here's Sadie Dingfelder with Warning, This Fruit May Orbisculate. In the early aughts, Hillary Krieger was sitting in her parents' Boston home when her friend accidentally squirted himself with an orange slice. I said, oh, the orange just orbisculated, she recalls, and he said, it did what? The two made a $5 bet, and Hillary gleefully grabbed the family dictionary. She flipped to the O section and stared at the spot on the page where orbisculate should have been. My first thought was, what's wrong with this dictionary? She says. Aghast, Hillary burst into her dad's study and told him the shocking news. Orbisculate is somehow not in the dictionary. And he looked kind of sheepish, and that's when I found out that he made up this word when he was in college and had just been using it our whole lives as if it were a real word, Hillary says. He'd always defined it as, quote, when you dig your spoon into a grapefruit and it squirts juice directly into your eye, unquote, she says, though the family also applied it to other fruits and vegetables that unexpectedly spritzed. Out $5 and wondering what other fake words might be lurking in her vocabulary, Hillary was mad at the time. But she quickly came to see her dad's made-up word as a gift, one that encapsulated his mischievous and inventive spirit. It speaks to his creativity and the idea that even when something's painful and annoying like getting grapefruit juice in your eye, you can laugh and have fun with it. Two decades later, Hillary found herself telling that funny story again and again in some very sad circumstances. Her father, Neil Krieger, died of complications from COVID-19 in April 2020 at age 78. Since the Kriegers couldn't have a proper funeral, Hillary, who now lives in New York, spent a lot of time on the phone talking with friends and family, and the orbisculate story kept coming up. I began to think orbisculate is such a great word. It should be in the dictionary, says Hillary, an editor at NBC News. Hillary, 44 years old, called her brother Jonathan Krieger, 36 years old, who lives in Boston and runs an online trivia company. And together, they hatched an elaborate plan to get their word officially recognized. Their goal is to put the word to use publicly enough that it has a chance of becoming legitimate. Getting a word into the dictionary isn't easy, but the Kriegers' 78-point plan, as described on their website, orbisculate.com, is spot on. Encouraging people to use orbisculate in a wide variety of contexts, such as comic strips, news stories, and the name of a Ben & Jerry's sorbet flavor, will leave a compelling trail of evidence for lexicographers to follow. Merriam-Webster adds about 1,000 new words to its master database every year, words that then trickle down to the company's print and online dictionaries. The batch of new words released in January 2021 is heavy on pandemic-related vocabulary, such as quote-unquote long hauler and quote-unquote pod. Editors at the dictionary's Whisper Quiet office in Springfield, Massachusetts, scour newspapers, academic journals, books, and even cartoon captions for new words. What we're looking for is usage in publications with a large and broad readership, says senior editor Emily Brewster. Brewster and her colleagues generally track words for years or even decades before nominating them for dictionary status. This ensures that flash-in-the-pan coinages, think Will Smith's use of jiggy to mean trendy, briefly popular in the 90s, can't sneak in. But if a word really takes off, it can quickly become official. The word that has the record for most quickly entering the dictionary is COVID-19 at 34 days, Brewster says. The term before that was AIDS. In addition to diseases, words that describe concrete phenomena that affect many people tend to get picked up quickly. That's one of the things orbisculate has going for it. There is no single word that captures the squirting in the eye that certain fruits do, she says. If the Krygers accomplish all of the goals they outline on their website, the word's status as an established member of the English language would be pretty irrefutable, Brewster says. But to make it all happen, they need help from friends and strangers. Even if they don't succeed in getting the word added to the dictionary, the Krygers' project may still accomplish something important. Perhaps just trying will help buffer them against some of the feelings of despair and hopelessness that have struck many families who have lost loved ones to the coronavirus, says psychologist Robert A. Niemeyer, Ph.D., director of the Portland Institute for Loss and Transition. Among the many reasons that virus-related grief has provided, especially shattering, is that social distancing separated mourners from their friends and family. This family has come up with a creative way of memorializing their father by building a community around this thing that's distinctive about him, Niemeyer says. That community, which the Krygers named Orbisculation Nation, even has a uniform of sorts, a citrus-festooned T-shirt, which you can buy on their website. Proceeds go to Carson's Village, a charity that helps families in mourning. Friends of the Krygerses often take pictures of themselves wearing their T-shirts and send their images via text messages to Hillary and Jonathan, just to have that reminder that there are people who are thinking about you and who care about you helps a lot, says Jonathan. The Orbisculation Nation is also helping the Krygers check off items on their list for Orbisculation Domination. One family friend went rogue and put a homemade Orbisculation warning sign on a pile of clementines in a grocery store. That was goal number 16, by the way. People the Krygers don't know personally, but who were inspired by the campaign, used the word in an online crossword puzzle, goal number 1, and a homemade cartoon, goal number 25. And when the Because Language podcast announced online voting to determine its word of the year, the Orbisculation Nation put its favorite word over the top. It's such a good word, it might have won even without the online campaign, says podcast host Daniel Midgley. Orbisculate felt like a refreshing splash of citrus in an otherwise grim year of words, he says. It has been more than a year since Neil's death, and his children are still reeling from the loss. But their campaign to get their father's word into the dictionary has helped them recapture a little of the joy that has been missing from their lives. I could picture him really excited, Jonathan says. He'd say, "It's dynamite." That's a thing he always used to say. Next in Reader's Digest, health. Breakthrough treatments in what's called regenerative medicine can be a lifesaver. Here's Patricia Pearson with How Our Own Cells Can Heal Us in Reader's Digest. Anissa Job first limped into the office of Riam Shama, MD, a sports medicine doctor and pain specialist in Toronto, in the year 2017. Job had been working as an aide in long-term care facilities when her back pain first appeared about a decade earlier. The cause, an undiagnosed herniated disc, which had pinched a nerve. As the pain worsened, Job gritted her teeth and tried to keep going. Now she was desperate for help. Working with frail seniors involves a lot of lifting, bending, and pulling. By November 2016, Job could scarcely walk even a short distance. Job's internist referred her to Dr. Shama, who began by administering nerve block injections, similar to an epidural, every few weeks. They held the pain at bay for anywhere from a few days to a few weeks, but then it always returned. Historically, the treatment of chronic back pain has been less than ideal, sometimes causing patients to become addicted to opioids or to undergo major, often unsuccessful, spinal fusion surgery, which is suitable for only about 1 in 20 patients. Hunting for a solution beyond these limited options, Dr. Shammah turned to stem cells, the building block cells found not just in embryos, but also in various tissues in adult bodies, which can generate an array of different cells. Specifically, he'd been studying bone marrow stem cells, and he invited Job to participate in a study with 23 other patients, cautioning that there were no guarantees. The procedure would use Job's own bone marrow, and it had been proved safe. The hope is that injecting the stem cells, known as mesenchymal stem cells, or MSCs, into the patient's herniated disc will regenerate and heal the damaged tissue. An MRI of Job's spine showed that two discs were causing her problem, which was good news as far as the procedure was concerned. Out of 5 levels on the lumbar spine, 1 or 2 showing damage tells you that the spine hasn't deteriorated everywhere, says Dr. Shammah. By contrast, when you have 5 levels of disc disease, in other words, the spine is really messed up, there is not a lot you can do. The procedure took 3.5 hours. It began with the extraction of Job's bone marrow, the most painful step, which was immediately distilled and concentrated into bone marrow aspirate concentrate, or BMAC, then injected into the discs. Guided by a type of X-ray called fluoroscopy, Dr. Shammah inserted a needle into Job's spine to place the BMAC into the discs. Job remained awake for the entire procedure in order to alert Dr. Shammah if he touched a nerve. Afterward, Job recovered in bed for 2 weeks and then, slowly, began to walk. A month later, she strode briskly into the clinic, a moment Dr. Shammah recalls with delight. Whereas Job had previously described her pain as, quote-unquote, beyond 10, she says that it's now a 2. When Dr. Shammah published his findings in the March 2021 issue of the medical journal Frontiers in Medicine, he reported that 90% of his patients gained 2 to 3 millimeters of height that had been lost due to disc compression, and 80% of them stopped using opioids. The use of stem cells is part of a field called regenerative medicine, which emerged 2 decades ago as a way to deploy the body's own cells to repair tissues by restoring their lost function. Several such therapies have already been approved by regulatory agencies around the world. The FDA has approved stem cell treatments for certain cancers, blood disorders, and immune disorders. But many more are in use, including skin substitutes for treating burns and healing surgical incisions. As researchers report from clinical trials all over the world, the hope is that stem cells will revolutionize the treatment of many conditions over the next decade. For instance, in a study treating congenital vision loss with retinal stem cells at the University of California, Irvine, one woman was able to see her family clearly for the first time in years. A German child suffering from a sometimes fatal skin disease called epidermolysis bullosa recovered after receiving a transplant of genetically modified skin cells at the University of Modena and Reggio Emilia in Italy. The actor Selma Blair reported last August that she was in symptom remission after participating in a stem cell transplant trial for multiple sclerosis. And a study on treating osteoarthritis underway in Ireland, France, and the Netherlands shows promising initial results. Despite these early successes, Dr. Shammah cautions that the science is so new that it is easily misunderstood and misapplied. There are a lot of snake oil salesmen out there, he says, pointing to private stem cell clinics all over the world that claim to cure such things as erectile dysfunction or dementia without genuine evidence and in defiance of regulatory bodies. In the future, says Shane Shapiro, MD, assistant professor of orthopedic surgery at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida, we're looking at regenerative medicine as something that will one day be a medical specialty of its own, much like cardiology or neurology. An early breakthrough occurred in the year 2006 when Shinya Yamanaka, MD, a molecular biologist at Kyoto University in Japan, showed that stem cell therapy could avoid the morally divisive use of embryonic stem cells. Instead, he discovered he could induce adult skin cells to develop into blood, bone, or liver cells. Dr. Yamanaka, who went on to win the Nobel Prize in the year 2012 for this work, differentiated these cells from the kind found in a fertilized egg, calling them, quote-unquote, induced pluripotent stem cells, or iPSCs. While an embryo's cells could turn into any part of the body, iPSCs could create many different types of tissues, but not all. This discovery moved the stem cell conversation past the sensitive subject of using fetal tissue for medical purposes, which is illegal in some countries, and the research began to take off. In the year 2014, Tokyo's Riken Research Institute performed the first successful iPSC transplant, creating retinal cells generated from skin cells of a patient with age-related macular degeneration, a serious eye condition. Shortly afterward, Henry Klassen, MD, at the University of California, Irvine, oversaw a trial for treating retinitis pigmentosa, a group of rare genetic disorders causing gradual blindness, in which a donor's retinal progenitor cells were transplanted into the eyes of 28 study participants. One of them, Kristen McDonald of Los Angeles, who had gone blind, regained what she describes as a burst of light. "I can navigate by light now and see more contrasts and shapes," says McDonald, now 65 years old. She has since become an outspoken patient advocate for stem cell trials. Then, in the year 2018, neurosurgeon Richard Fessler, MD, of Rush University Medical Center in Chicago, oversaw a year-long trial with iPSC-derived motor neurons transplanted into six patients paralyzed by spinal cord injuries. Dr. Fessler reported that all regained some upper body movement and that a patient who was able to only shrug his shoulders could now eat, write, and do other tasks with his hands. This is the kind of breakthrough that the late actor Christopher Reeve, best known for playing Superman, was advocating for from his wheelchair after suffering neck-down paralysis following a horseback riding accident in the year 1995. At that time, governments around the world were making moves to restrict embryonic stem cell research. In certain cases, embryonic stem cells are in medical use today. They're derived from leftover blastocysts, a clustering of cells in a fertilized egg that didn't implant during IVF treatment. These are still early days, with much to investigate in terms of safety and dosing, not to mention the question of how to manufacture iPSCs for different conditions. But Dr. Yamanaka predicted in the year 2018 that several treatments using regenerative medicine and new drugs would be developed, authorized, and covered by insurance as soon as the year 2030. In the meantime, the first generation of stem cell treatments that have regulatory approval in the United States, as well as in Canada and Europe, largely involve simple cell transplants, ones that move the patient's own cells from one part of the body to another, such as the procedure Dr. Shamaa performed on Anissa Jobb. That said, stem cell transplants for blood diseases such as leukemia, which have been carried out for several years, are the one exception where cells from a matching donor are also allowed. Among approved procedures, the most common is the transfer of BMAC to the spine or the knee. While Job sought treatment for her back pain, Rodolfo Corsini, now 58 years old, was looking for relief for job-related knee pain when he visited Humanitas Research Hospital in Milan, Italy in the year 2020. He hadn't heard of BMAC until it was suggested to him by a surgeon, Elisaveta Kohn, MD, who didn't see enough damage to merit knee replacement surgery. Corsini agreed to the injection, and it was a success. "I can do almost everything that I did before," he says. Dr. Kohn, along with some European colleagues, is now involved in a number of exploratory studies, including a comparison of treating patients with BMAC and another type of adult stem cell, called stromal vascular fraction, or SVF, which is extracted from a person's fat tissue. Will it work? Certainly the early research on BMAC provides hope, although with limitations. We couch these treatments as something to help with a chronic degenerative condition, something that in many cases can be successful in managing the symptoms and improving quality of life, but in most cases are not a cure, Dr. Shane Shapiro says. The analogy should be diabetes or high cholesterol. We don't cure those things, we treat them. What we would like to see in the future is a way to treat arthritis without metal and plastic, or to treat degenerative disc disease without a spinal fusion. That's the ultimate goal. Researchers at 10 European institutions are currently working together toward that goal, and also on a way to skip the painful bone marrow extraction procedure that Job underwent. Instead, says research scientist Mary Murphy at the National University of Ireland, Galway, they hope to create mesenchymal stem cells in the laboratory in a standardized, cost-effective, and high-volume way. Because regenerative medicine is still young, patients should be wary of profit-hungry companies selling fraudulent stem cell products as if they were magic potions to cure everything from hair loss to Lyme disease. Instead, consult with a medical expert on your specific condition to learn your options. If it's knee arthritis, start with a specialist in orthopedic surgery or sports medicine, advises Dr. Shapiro. If it's degenerative disc disease of the lumbar spine, start with a spine specialist. Then, seek a referral to someone in that field who has expertise in regenerative medicine. For many patients, stem cell therapy is already making a lasting difference to their quality of life. "My husband and I went hiking last summer," Job says. "I walked a half mile. I was so excited. I thought maybe I could start cross-country skiing. Why not?" And let's conclude this edition of Reader's Digest with a list. 13 things. National parks made for you and me, from Emily Goodman of Reader's Digest. Number 1. While the term, quote-unquote, national park conjures images of the American West, there are national park units in every U.S. state and territory. Together, they welcome about 300 million visitors each year and span some 85 million acres, almost 55 million of which are in Alaska. Number 2. There are more than 400 sites in the national park system, though that includes far more than what we traditionally think of as quote-unquote parks, such as parkways and rivers. Strictly speaking, there are 63 national parks. California has the most, with 9. But there are also national historic parks, national military parks, and other designations. A few are thoroughly unique. Among them, the White House. Number 3. The National Park Service, NPS, oversees all 400-plus of these sites, so Alfred Hitchcock, in the year 1958, needed the agency's permission to shoot part of his film North by Northwest at Mount Rushmore, which is a national memorial. Despite initially granting him permission, the NPS later revoked Hitchcock's permit in the midst of filming, objecting to the chase scene across the presidential faces. Hitchcock had promised he would not tread upon the sculpture. He ended up filming the remainder of the movie on a mock-up of the monument. Number 4. Rules about what you can and cannot do in national parks differ from site to site. Activities that are prohibited at national parks, such as hunting and fishing, are allowed on some national preserves. Many national parks allow the scattering of ashes, like the Grand Canyon, a notable example, though, like Hitchcock, you need to obtain NPS permission. The same goes for couples who wish to marry inside a national park. Number 5. Additions to the national park system generally require acts of Congress, but presidents can name new national monuments. Of the 63 national parks, only one is named after a president, Theodore Roosevelt National Park in North Dakota. Number 6. It was another president who created the NPS in 1916, Woodrow Wilson. Parks that predate the NPS include Yosemite in California and Mount Rainier in Washington. But Yellowstone, which turned 150 years old this year, was the world's first national park. Today, more than 100 countries have national parks and preserves. The largest by area is in Greenland, though a whopping 97% of the Galapagos Islands is a national park. Number 7. Yellowstone is home to some of the most pristine aquatic ecosystems in the country, as well as more than half the world's geysers. Among record setters include Mammoth Cave National Park in Kentucky, which has the longest known cave system in the world, White Sands National Park in New Mexico, where you'll find the world's largest gypsum dune field, and Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks in California, home of the biggest and second biggest tree in the world, respectively. Number 8. Among the hardest parks to access are Dry Tortugas in Florida off Key West and Isle Royale in Michigan, surrounded by Lake Superior, both accessible only by boat or seaplane. But one of the hardest to explore is Gates of the Arctic in Alaska, our northernmost national park. It has no roads, no trails, no campsites, and, perhaps most frightening, no cell service. Number 9. The NPS employs 20,000 workers, but relies on more than 10 times that many volunteers, 279,000 in the year 2019. A big perk for volunteers is free admission. Those with more than 250 service hours are exempt from any entrance fees, as are members of the military, the families of fallen service members, known as Gold Star families, and all children under the age of 15. And thanks to a federal youth initiative called Every Kid Outdoors, fourth graders get their entire immediate families into any park free of charge all year long. Number 10. On a few days each year, the national parks are free to all. Martin Luther King Jr. Day, the third Monday of January, the first day of National Park Week, held in April, usually in conjunction with Earth Day, the anniversary of the Great American Outdoors Act, August 4th, National Public Lands Day, September 24th, and Veterans Day, usually November 11th. Number 11. That said, only about a quarter of the parks charge admission. That money remains within the NPS, and at least 80% of it stays in the park where it was collected, funding things such as visitor access and habitat restoration. Supplementing those funds are the official NPS budget of $3.5 billion, as well as private donations. Number 12. Want to explore one of the traditionally less crowded national parks? North Cascades in Washington, Lassen Volcanic in California, Congaree in South Carolina, Big Bend in Texas, and Great Basin in Nevada are among the least visited, at least for now. Finally, number 13 of 13 things about national parks made for you and me. The newest national park is New River Gorge in West Virginia, though ironically the New River is thought to be the oldest river in North America. Other recent additions to the roster include the Dwight D. Eisenhower Memorial in Washington, D.C., the Medgar and Merle Evers Home National Monument in Mississippi, and Camp Nelson National Monument in Kentucky. But more are surely coming, as the National Parks Conservation Association's goal is to protect 30% of America's lands and waters by the year 2030. You have been listening to Reader's Digest on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program is replayed after 9 o'clock in the evening. This is John Fisher saying goodbye from Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio.